Welcome to Hot Plate, the conversations we should be having about our food and drink. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, special guest Chef Suzanne Barr joins us to pick up the conversation on cultural appropriation. I celebrate a milestone, then we discuss a perplexing study before diving into a blind beer date. Josh, now we have a guest in the studio again today.
We do!
Very exciting. The fantastic chef Suzanne Barr.
Welcome.
Hey. Welcome.
How nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And Suzanne was the owner of Saturday Dinette Restaurant and more recently is featured in a documentary called The Heat, A Kitchen Revolution. That's which is awesome. Out now. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's really it still amazes me that the film that I had the opportunity to be a part of the film, because I remember when Maya first contacted me, Maya Gallis, the director, it was maybe 2 years, a year before we actually started really filming, and she came in and she came to the restaurant and she was like, "So I'm working on this documentary. It's about females in the kitchen. Would you like to be a part of it?" And I was like, Yeah, sure. I'm really busy. I gotta go." And I just like kind of like forgot about it. And she said, "We'll be back in contact." And eventually, she got back in contact. And then the filming started like literally a year later. Now, we knew nothing of any of the other co-stars within the film. And so for us, it was just kind of like we were just telling our story. We were telling what was happening at Saturday Dinette. We were opening another restaurant. I was then going to the Gladstone. So it was a little surreal because I didn't know anything of what the film was going to look like, the body, the base, the volume, the magnitude that it's kind of gaining, the momentum. It's so amazing how well the film has been doing. And I'm so excited to be a part of that and to be a part of history within this film.
So, Suzanne, we've brought you in today to tackle an easy topic.
Just a quickie.
Yeah.
Totally.
And back in episode 8, Joshna and I started a conversation about cultural appropriation in the kitchen. And the idea of if one person cooks something that is from a different background than theirs, is it okay? Is it not okay? Where is the line? And we ended up coming up with more questions than we did answers. Yeah. And we thought we need to call in some reinforcements.
That's
and Joshna said, "I know the woman."
Yes. So maybe we start off with, I'd love it if you tell us what you think it is. What does that look like in the context of restaurants or bars or, you know, something like that?
Right. So I don't have my Wikipedia definition, nor do I want my Wikipedia definition.
Yeah.
But I will start with is actually what's happening for me right now, presently in my life. So I've signed on to a project that I'm very excited to be a part of. That's actually here in Toronto on King Street East called True True Diner. And I came on initially as consultant to make this restaurant kind of feel more a restaurant, a sit-down dining experience. Now, the owner didn't know anything other than maybe what he'd heard from a few people about me, but I have never cooked Italian food. I do not have any cultural identity that I know of to Italian cuisine, but as being a chef and as being someone that is a lover of food and as a person that appreciates food that has influenced me, and spending over maybe roughly about 2 months traveling in Italy, I thought, yeah, I think I can do this. Mm-hmm. And so I created a menu. And then out of creating that menu came then another conversation and then another amazing opportunity to become a partner of this project. So this project closed the doors as a pizzeria, as a fast casual pizzeria just this week. And we are in the process of restructuring it and rebuilding it and remodeling it to reopen as a diner called True True Italian Diner. So I asked the question early in the conversations, how does it feel for you to have a Black woman cooking as your chef, being named as your executive chef, to now be running this Italian diner?
Right.
Like, what is that about?
Yeah.
Like, one, what is Italian diner? What is an Italian diner? And then two, like, can I really be as authentic as the many, many amazing Italian restaurants that are here in Toronto that have representation on top of representation? What can I bring to it that I feel would actually make an impact that's already making an impact in the city? And so I had to go deep. I had to go so deep into thinking about what diner meant for me and what Saturday Dinette meant for me.
Right.
You know, how many conversations am I going to be invited to where someone's going to say, how do you feel that you have the right to make Italian food when you've never, one, done it? Two, you are not Italian. Three, you may have spent 2 months there, but what do you know about the richness of the people, the richness of the language, the richness of the culture? And I said, because my people, my culture, everything that we are about is as rich as what you're about. So why can't I not? Of course I can. And that just empowered me. You know, it really has empowered me. And this conversation is going to empower me so that I can continue to talk about what my plan is to do at that restaurant. And it not just be this voice of creating Italian food that only speaks to Italian people, that only know Italian, that expect it to be what it's expected to be. Because when you expect it to be what you think it is, that's when you miss the opportunity to surprise people.
So let's talk about the other side for a minute, because going into our initial conversation, my impression had always been, I don't care who's cooking. If you have an appreciation for the food of another culture, you can cook the food of that other culture. And it's quite convenient that we're talking about Italian food because I have an Italian background. And when I go to an Italian restaurant, I don't care who's cooking behind there because it's not going to be exactly Italian food. Exactly Italian food is like what my nonna made, what my zia made. I really don't care who's cooking. That being said, when we started the conversation, Joshna did bring up a few examples that made me uncomfortable. So I want to take a moment to think about or to discuss, when is it not okay?
When you look at the demographics of the background of most kitchens, they don't look like anything that is a cuisine that we are actually focusing or even talking about here.
If we heard the story the other way around, where there was some Italian dude who spent 2 months in Jamaica and was like, hey, man, I got it. It's cool. Me and the jerk. I'm going to open up my own spot. I can feel us being up in arms about that.
It's not so much that I would be up in arms about it. I would be very curious and very excited to taste where did he go? How long did he spend? And who did he cook with? And what is he making? And who's working in the kitchen? I think that first I'd want to go and taste it. And then second, I'd be like, okay, well, I would have to be honest. I'd have to be like, it's not my jerk sauce. It's good. Would I come back? I don't know. You know, and I think that that's my only true, honest question or response to that is that I need to kind of, you know, feel out the situation, feel out the vibe, feel out how he approached it. Like, how is the entrance into your space? Like, there's so many parts to your experience in having Jamaican food and the memories that it brings back and memories that it conjures for me. Because I know when I go to The Real Jerk and on the East End, and when I step into that space, I immediately get transported back to when I was 15 years old, going to like the first Jamaican spot outside of my own parents' house and like eating Jamaican food in this little, you know, spot, and we're eating it out of the styrofoam container. And I want to make sure that memory, that flashback, that evocation is there and that it's happening, because that's part of why I go out to enjoy restaurants. That's why I do what I do as a chef and as a restaurateur, is that I want to create that same experience for anybody that steps into our space.
So where is there a line for you? You said you'll feel it out. What sort of things would rub you the wrong way? Or do you just feel cultural appropriation is not a thing in the kitchen?
Oh, no, I think it's absolutely a thing. But I think that I don't think that it's a thing that bothers me to the point where I will say, I'm not going to eat there because you are of a non-cultural representing the food that you're making. I'm not saying that at all, because then you would probably have to stop eating at every restaurant in the city.
Well, exactly. That's the sort of material truth, right?
That's the truth. Because the people that are making the foods in every single restaurant in this city are not the ones that are actually culturally attached to this food.
That's big, right? That's a big
it's
bit
the
of
truth.
And it is entirely the truth. I think that there's a respect and there's an intentions piece.
Yes.
Right? What is in
intention
your mind?
Intention is a very important word to put into literally side by side with respect. Yeah.
There's a way to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't think drawing lines and saying you're allowed to do this and you're not allowed to do this is really the future or the way forward. But to really consider the attitude with which it's being done and the sort of the loving embrace of, you know, and the respect that comes with it, may be the easiest way for us to navigate this.
In my position right now with True True Diner, and another project that I'm working on. I think it's important to be able to really exemplify that to my team, to have the people that are working alongside me understand the importance of the respect and the intention behind the purpose of why a dish is being even considered to be on this menu. You know, and if we're putting this on the menu, is it to say that it's the best and there's nothing else like it? We all want to think that and we all want to believe that. But I think the intention is to evoke the memory and experience that it's going to be very specific to what True True Diner will become known for and what I have been known for in this city. And it's an honor to continue to be able to cook and to be able to utilize and have access to all of the cultural beauties that make up this city, and to not feel like I have to choose day to day, like I have to make this because I said I'm doing this, or I have to do that because I'm over here. But because of the intention of my love for the craft and my love for being a woman of color in my position, I will continue to do this work and to be able to challenge and have these conversations. So thank you, guys.
Has there been a time where something happened and you just thought, that's not right?
Yeah. There's been a few times for that. This is my one thing that I'm not about, and it's not about calling out. It's about calling in people to recognize what is a problem and what is not working.
Wonderful.
And what is inaccurate to what you are saying is authentic, which is not. What is missing? What is not being really considered as something that is so sensitive to race and culture? And when you're speaking on someone's food, when you're speaking on someone's culture, language, customs, traditions, practices, that is when it's has to be called in, not called out, called in to recognize. And calling in is about either making contact directly with the owner, making contact with the individuals that are in that particular space, to ask the questions, to push back a little bit, to push forward, to bring in, because we are so quick. We are in an industry, we're in a time where it's all about social media and people putting people on blast for doing the wrong thing and not being conscious, not being sensitive, not being really aware of their wrongdoings or their right doings or their unknown doings, but calling them in for, let me help you out. Let me recognize. Let me point some things out. Let me enlighten you. Let me support you.
I think that feels good to me, being able to talk about it, because I feel the fire inside of me, and sometimes I have a hard time really articulating what that's all about.
I'm with you.
Woo!
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Okay, Mirella.
Yes.
A little birdie told me that you are celebrating a very nice anniversary right now.
I am.
Tell us, what is it?
I'm so proud. It's the 5th anniversary of the publication of my award-winning beer book.
Woo! Name of the book?
It's called Beerology, Everything You Need to Know to Enjoy Beer Even More.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations.
I'm so proud. It's in its 5th printing. It's now available in French and in German. It's won awards. And for it to still be around and selling well 5 years later, to me, just feels great.
That is a big deal. That is delightful. Congratulations. In celebration of this lovely anniversary,
okay,
I have compiled a few questions for you.
Ooh, a little AMA?
A little bit. And I have lots of questions about beer.
Okay.
I am woefully uneducated, and you are exactly the opposite. So if you will indulge me,
sure,
with some of these questions. As an expert, is there a popular misconception about beer that you would like to correct?
It's not so much a misconception, but here's something that still nags me.
Tell me.
People who, I'm doing air quotes, don't like beer.
Okay.
That drives me nuts, because saying I don't like beer is like saying I don't like vegetables.
Okay.
There are so many beers out there. Beer, I think, is the most varied beverage. It can range from, well, now 0% alcohol all the way to well into the 30, 30-something percent alcohol. It can be dark, it can be clear, it can be sour, it can be bitter, it can be any combination of the above, it can be sweet, it can have any of a range of notes. And people who just taste one beer or have a few and decide, nope, I don't like it, and don't give themselves that opportunity, they're missing out. It's okay. A delicious beverage. Don't make that blanket statement. Look around. You'll find a beer you love.
Is there ever an appropriate moment to serve warm beer?
Are we talking warm or are we talking hot?
I'm talking warm, like not, from my understanding, it's like, gotta have the cold beer, gotta have cold beer.
Ah.
Right? Is there a scenario where maybe it's like room temperature, not that sort of preferred ice cold vibe? Is there ever a context in which that is not bad form?
Absolutely. Well, it depends on the beer. So beer, like wine, is divided into different categories, and some categories shine when they're served very cold. So we're talking about really crisp, refreshing beers, pilsners, anything that's meant to just refresh and isn't super flavorful. Those are the beers that should be served cold. And for many years, that's what beer was, right? So that's where that stereotype comes from. Technically, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius.
Thank you.
But when we're getting into more flavorful beers, absolutely, you want to have them, I wouldn't say warm, but a little bit warmer, and very complex beers at cellar temperature, which is, 13 to 15. I don't think anyone should be putting a thermometer in their beer.
Right.
But what I usually say, if it's crisp and refreshing, drink it right out of the fridge. If it's a little bit more complex, full flavored, pull it out of the fridge maybe 20 minutes before you're going to drink it. Or if you're me, pull the second one out when you grab the first one. And then the first one might be a little cold.
Smart.
By the time you get to the second one,
I love that.
It'll be the right temperature. That being said, you did mention warm. It is possible to mull beer. If you haven't had mulled beer, it is delicious.
Really?
My favorite mulled beer is made with apples. It's called lamb's wool. You cook the apples into the beer and the apples disintegrate and it looks a little bit like wool in the beer.
Of course.
Yeah, very traditional English recipe. I've given it my own twist, and that's on my website, beerology.ca, if ever you want to check it out. It is delicious.
Okay, I love that. I want to taste that. All right. Next question, a bit more serious. What do you think that women bring to the craft of brewing beer? Is there a female way to do this?
That's a tough question. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't like to really get into, women are more like this and men are more like this, which is sort of a slippery
Mars
slope.
And Venus thing.
Yeah. I think one thing I can certainly say is that women bring diversity. And the other thing I can speak to from, a personal experience and what I've seen is more women in the industry brings more women both in the industry and as drinkers, right?
Mm.
It's an invitation for women, more women to come and enjoy beer, which I'm seeing more and more. But historically, when I started in beer over 10 years ago, I would go to beer events and I would be the only woman there or one of a handful. And I've gotten many, many comments from women, both drinkers and in the industry, saying that seeing me there, encouraged them and made them feel like they would also be welcome. So I think that's super
that's really
important.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, what I want to see now is more cultural diversity in beer. That is the next step, frontier.
So tell us the difference between an ale and a lager.
That's a common question.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between an ale and a lager is in the yeast that is used to brew them. I like to speak from a drinker perspective. I could get into the science of the temperature at which it's brewed, blah, blah, blah. They're not particularly interesting from a drinker perspective. So what I like to say is that lager yeasts, so the yeast that make lager beers, are slow and meticulous. So what they can do is chew through a much broader range of sugars. So a beer that is a lager that's brewed with lager yeast will be drier, have less residual sugar, and a lighter body. Also, yeast, as it is producing alcohol, will produce all kinds of other compounds, and the lager yeast will clean up those compounds, leaving you with a very crisp beer. That is, has a slightly lighter body and really focuses just on your malt and hop flavors. Ale yeasts, on the other hand, I like to say they're fast and sloppy.
Okay.
So they ferment through a lot more quickly. A yeast is not a robot. It is a living organism. So as it is converting sugar into alcohol, it'll produce other characters that can be fruity, that can be spicy. Sometimes, other notes will come in there, and the ales will just leave those in the beer and move on with their business.
Okay.
So an ale will have, as a general rule, a lot more complexity to it, a little bit fuller body. So you're going to get not only your malt and your hop flavors, but a little bit of fruitiness or a little spice or a little something extra.
Okay.
Now that's the theory. In practice, brewers can manipulate things and the lines are blurred. And at the end of the day, I'm actually moving away from talking about ales and lagers. And it's interesting you should mention this in the context of my book.
Yes.
Because I think the whole ale lager division comes to us from wine. Wine is so neatly packaged into red and white wine. And people come into beer and they want a similar package. And I had a very long conversation with my publisher who was suggesting that I divide the beers in my book into ale and lager.
The same. Okay.
And I just feel that is not the most useful way to divide beers. And instead, what I did is I divided them by broader flavor categories. So I have the mellow brews that are malty and richer in flavor.
I see.
Then I've got the refreshing brews, which we touched on
earlier,
the striking brews that have like sharper, brighter flavors, be it acidity or bitterness. And then I have the brews that are sort of more rich and intense. So I find that beer being so complex, as I mentioned earlier, so many different ones, to just say ale versus lager, it's a little too easy. And not to mention the fact that most beers are ales and just a few of them are lagers. I guess there's more red wine than white in the balance of things.
Be, yeah.
Yeah, it would be similar in that way.
Okay, that's super helpful. Thanks. I feel like I have a lot more information now. Could you tell us, last or final run, what do you love about beer?
It's delicious.
It's the flavor. I love that.
And I particularly love the way, as it warms, it evolves. As I'm getting through the glass, it's just delicious. Josh, I was very entertained with this article that you forwarded to me about food safety in cookbooks.
It's almost like it came from The Onion, right?
It was weird to read.
It was totally weird.
It was surreal.
Yeah. I read it a couple of times, not believing that this is actually where we were.
It's based on a study.
Right? It's based on a real study. It's like legitimate concern about this particular issue. So the piece is, the issue is that studies, this study has found that there is what they are determining is an inadequate advice and knowledge about proper food handling and food safety in cookbooks and in written recipes.
Right. Weren't they saying that you have to tell people in recipes to wash their hands and to prepare their food on a clean surface?
This is what they're suggesting, right? And that cooking times for meats were not accurate to what sort of local public health standards are, and that there should be more focused temperatures so that a thermometer can be employed. And to mention that if you're cutting chicken on a board, that you need to remove that board and wash it and pull up a new board to cut your bread or vegetables or whatever it is. And that I was completely shocked at the notion that this is the responsibility of a recipe writer.
It just didn't make sense to me. I mean, who's preparing food on a dirty surface, and how is that the responsibility of the person who wrote the book?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all. And the idea that this is a recipe writer's challenge or responsibility, because the author of the piece that I connected you to said that, one of the failings here is that oftentimes people who write recipes are not even cooks themselves, and they don't have that experience in the kitchen, which is why this information doesn't make it into the recipe words. I push back. I think that I don't think that it should be a recipe writer's responsibility to remind people to wash their hands before they start cooking.
The author wrote 10% of the books had risky food preparation directions, namely related to thawing and washing. What would be a risky food preparation direction?
I'm going to guess that they
understand.
Probably tell you they're probably not as much advice to wash things.
Okay.
Right? Like, I remember there's a lot of historical practice around rinsing chickens.
Okay.
Raw chickens,
yes.
Particularly in a bit of vinegar. right?
To there was sort a huge hoopla about that a couple of weeks ago. Don't wash your chicken because then you'll get chicken everywhere and that's dangerous.
And so I'm going to guess that the objection is the fact that the recipe did not explicitly tell you to wash that chicken or rinse this thing or, right? That's what I'm going to guess this is all about.
And I'm not going to lie, every time I have to thaw meat, I do have a mini panic. I mean, it is, I know it's a thing you have to do carefully,
there's
but I just Google it.
We have
all of the information at our fingertips, or, you know, I'll call my mom.
Completely, right?
It's so weird that they want that in the book.
It's so weird. And what I really think the issue here, I don't think the issue is really unaddressed. I think the main problem is that we collectively have such a low level of understanding of how to behave in a kitchen. If this is in fact a problem, and we are getting increasing levels of foodborne illness out of home cooking, right, which is what is being suggested here,
right,
then our resting knowledge needs to boost. It's not that the recipe needs to tell you to wash your hands. It's you just need to learn more about how to behave yourself in a kitchen, right?
I agree with you 100% there. But the other piece is they're also promoting a decrease in literacy in the kitchen by saying, if you want to know if the meat is cooked, you have to use a thermometer. And these books are using all kinds of other ways, like looking at it and understanding from the texture and poke. It's just, you know, what if I don't have access to a thermometer or you know, what if
my thermometer breaks?
Yeah. I need to have other ways to check if the, I mean, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Food thermometer has changed my life because I used to overcook all my meats because I was worried, and now I can just pop it in and
you know you're safe.
It's still tender.
Right. But there's still lots of diagnostics around how it feels, what color the juices are that run when you pierce the thing, just generally how long it's been in the oven.
Right. So I would argue that they're pushing people in the other way and diminishing literacy even more saying you have to use a thermometer. Efforts should be made to educate Canadian chefs on safe food handling practices so that they can promote positive behavior messages conducive to promoting food safety to consumers.
It's totally nuts.
I'm so sad to hear, Josh, now that chefs are not educated.
We're not on that educated on proper food
safety.
Handling.
I'm sure that's not at all taught in chef school.
No, right? Yeah,
no.
Not at all.
I'm sure it's all plating.
It's all just plating and tweezers.
And poking at meat to see if it's ready. With no hand washing.
Varying stages of golden brown.
Again, another fantastic study. The things they study. It's time for a blind beer date.
Blind beer date.
And I've brought another unique product for you here today, Josh. Now, this is out of my cellar. You can see that it's dusty.
Oh, very nice.
And are you able to read the label there?
It does. This very sweet label just says quelque chose.
Quelque chose.
How nice.
This is a beer from Quebec.
Okay.
It's brewed by Unibrew. And what makes this beer unique, as far as I know, certainly the only beer I've come across that's like this, is it is designed to be served warm.
Dun, dun, dun.
So you'll see I also brought...
Oh, she has a thermos.
A thermos.
You have a thermos of hot warm beer?
I do. Ah! That's why the bottle's empty. Yeah. So hopefully it's still warm. This is a great thermos. So.
Okay. Oh.
So this beer, the style is inspired by the Flanders Red, which we had in our last blind beer date. But this has cherries in it as well.
That fruitiness. You can see it and you can smell a little bit of the sweetness.
And you'll notice when you drink it that the carbonation is gone. That's one of the things that
happens when you warm it up. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's have a taste of this. Oh, that's delicious.
Yeah.
Oh, that is really good.
Imagine
that
a cold winter day.
That is boozy and dreamy.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Quelque chose.
It's got the really warm cherry flavors.
Totally.
It is slightly sweet.
But it even hits you like a toddy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, that's very good. Okay. So component A of the date is this delicious warm beer. I have brought you a hunk of double smoked cheddar.
Okay.
Right? Looking for this double smoked cheddar is looking for love.
Mm-hmm.
Been hanging out in my fridge for a while, haven't done anything with it. Thought, let's take you out and get you some action, cheddar.
It's waiting for the right beer.
I think that's really the truth.
So can I ask
you
here?
Think? Yeah.
I'm looking at this cheese and there's it's dark around the edges. Is that from the smoking?
Yes.
So this is, it is actually smoked. Like it's not infused with smoke.
Not at all. This hunk of cheese was put in a smoker.
Yeah, I can see from
And you can see the two-tone
edges
on that color there, right? So shall we individually try it and then just see how these two beauties might pair up with each
Let's
other?
Let's do it. Okay. I might have a bite of cheese first.
Yeah, yeah.
I took a cheese class once. Mm-hmm. And the teacher, I was just about to take my first bite, and she said, before you taste the cheese, nose the cheese.
Nose the cheese.
A huge aha moment for me. I've spent my whole career telling people, always smell the beer before you taste the beer. And it occurred to me, we should be doing that with everything we consume. Everything.
Yep.
Oh, this is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
The smoke is not too intense, but it's playing well off the sharper notes of the cheddar.
Exactly. The boldness of the cheddar balances, like it plays with the smoke really well.
I'm not going to lie. I'm getting excited. I have hope for this pairing.
There could be some good love here. Okay.
There was a burst of caramel there. Did
there
you get that burst?
There was totally a burst of caramel.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It became another thing.
Yes.
Right? The union.
I think we might have found an elusive third flavor.
Right?
It's only our second blind beer date.
Come on. We already
found a third flavor.
We're doing such good matchmaking.
Here's my question to you, though. Is the beer a little bossy? Are we losing the cheese?
In the height of the beeriness of that mouthful, you still have those funky notes of the cheese really holding strong, right?
Yeah.
Man, that's good.
I know. This is amazing pairing.
It's really good.
The way the when you have them both in your mouth, the richness of the beer fades and leaves the dryness of the cheese. And then that dryness leaves your mouth screaming for more beer.
For more beer, which is the ultimate in a beer pairing, is a thing
Agreed.
That pulls you back to the bottle as it would be.
Couldn't have been better if it was planned.
Man.
Cheers.
Kelka shows.
Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying The Hot Plate, rate us or leave a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thank you to Joshna for joining us today. Hot Plate is recorded at Eggplant Picture and Sound Studios. Our audio engineer is Brad Tigwell. Original music by Dave Bell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. That's a wrap.